Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Ariel Waldman describes her work as making massively multiplayer science. That ranges from being the global director of Science Hack Day, a multi-country concentrated two-day event where participants make both fanciful and practical devices and objects, to the founder of spacehack.org, which does many of the same things with space exploration. She was co-author of a congressionally requested National Academies of Sciences study on the future of human spaceflight, and also sits on the council for NASA's Innovative Advanced Concepts, a program that nurtures radical sci-fi ideas that could transform future space missions. In 2013, Waldman received a White House honor as a champion of change in citizen science. That's a big focus of her work, citizen science, and her latest project is a family book for children and parents titled What's It Like in Space? Stories from Astronauts Who've Been There. While some of the book is geared towards kids' inevitable questions about body functions and eating in space, it also offers insights on the complex orientation needed for humans to live and work in microgravity. Ariel Waldman joins us today here on Studio Tulsa. Ariel Waldman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Before we talk a little bit about your book, which is written for families, it's a really wonderful book about astronauts' experience in microgravity and in space. We're in this sort of interesting area as far as space, perhaps planning to return to the moon at some point, maybe thinking about going to Mars. And so at this point, we're sort of, other than the International Space Station, really there's a lot of preparation in case we decide at some point to go back to the moon or further to Mars. There's a lot of basic research in how we're going to be able to accomplish that. What's perhaps the most interesting thing you're hearing about today in this sort of preparation stage?
Oh, wow. There's a lot of stuff going on. I think the thing that was most interesting to me that I recently came across was astronauts on the International Space Station were controlling rovers here on Earth telerobotically. And I thought that was really cool because one concept as we look to the future of human space exploration is the idea of having astronauts actually orbiting Mars and telerobotically controlling rovers on the surface of Mars as they orbit the planet.
That's really cool. And I think, you know, the success of the Mars rovers has sort of let us, you know, no one expected those things to keep working for as long as they have.
Mm-hmm.
So would they use the robotic vehicles as a way of exploring Mars as opposed to going down to the surface themselves?
So a lot of people talk about telerobotically controlling rovers on the surface of Mars as sort of a step in between humans actually putting boots on the ground on Mars. So it's one option of many options that we have as sort of building a pathway to Mars. And the idea with astronauts sort of joysticking rovers, it really gives weight to the fact that, you know, to control rovers right now, we're dealing with, you know, a lot of light time delay. So astronauts who are actually controlling rovers from orbit would be able to actually conduct a lot more science with those rovers than we are able to do from Earth.
I think the success of the manned moon exploration has given maybe most average lay people unrealistic expectations of going to Mars. You know, I mean, because really the manned space exploration, with the exception of Apollo 13, which, you know, there's no loss of life, was really a fortuitous circumstance when you actually get into all of the decisions and all the engineering that went into it. If to go to like a planet like Mars, what is the exponential factor on the variables, the things that have to be worked out for a manned landing on Mars to be successful?
Yeah, so this is something that I personally learned a lot about over the last several years. I used to also think like, oh, well, we went to the moon and Mars is a bit more difficult, but, you know, we can do it, no problem. And I really underestimated just how much more difficult going to Mars is. It's more difficult in cost, in political collaboration and political will. It's more difficult in technology and pretty much everything you can imagine. So, yeah, I absolutely see people day to day really underestimating just how difficult it is to go to Mars. There's a lot of factors at play, but looking at it from the technology side, things like building an entry, descent, and landing module for humans on Mars hasn't been created by anyone. So, you know, there's a lot of technologies that are needed that are possible, but no one has created them yet. And so going to Mars is just incredibly, incredibly difficult. And some of it's the distance, some of it's the fact that, you know, it has just enough of an atmosphere to be really cumbersome to try and land into. And the fact that, you know, any way you cut it, even if you are using a lot of today's innovations and inventions, you're still looking at something that is hundreds of billions of dollars over decades. And so the thing that's really exciting about this to me is the fact that if we do end up sending a human to land on the surface of Mars, it's going to require collaboration on an unprecedented amount to make it actually happen. And so, you know, it's easy to get a little bit bummed out, I guess, when you hear about how difficult Mars is. But at the same time, if we make it happen, it will be so much more of a huge achievement for humanity as a whole than landing on the moon was.
And despite the political ups and downs between, say, the United States and the, Russia or China, for that matter, it seems like space is the one area where we tend to cooperate, even if our political relations are not the greatest.
For the most part, that's true, although, you know, sometimes it's still shaky. So one of the things that's really frustrating is the fact that Congress has actually mandated that NASA not collaborate with China at all. And this is purely a political thing because NASA wants to collaborate with China but is not allowed to currently. So there are definitely some hurdles to overcome. And while we collaborate a lot in space, space is often seen as sort of a token for our relations with other countries. So it can be used in a positive way to show that we're rebuilding relationships as we've done with Russia. But it can also be used, like it currently is being used with China, as sort of a thing to say, well, we're not going to collaborate with you because we disagree with the way you do something completely different that has nothing to do with space.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that is occurring is a lot of people are studying this idea of a manned long-duration spaceflight. Of course, the NASA twin studies with the Kelly brothers has gotten a ton of publicity. Have we found any final results? It's only been a few months, but what do we know about the twin studies as far as the changes in physiology between the two brothers, other than the fact that the first thing reported was that the one that went into space was 2 inches taller when he came home. But have we found any really big physiological differences?
So the results still haven't been really looked at yet, just because while Scott Kelly himself landed a few months ago from the International Space Station, all of his bodily fluids actually just very recently, like within the last week or two, just came back down from space on a different ship. So actually, I saw pictures in the last few days of people at NASA unpacking, you know, the ice packs of his bodily fluids around everything. So they've just begun looking at that stuff. So nothing yet, but I'm very interested to see if they do discover any differences that are of significance.
Now, another experiment that's going on, I believe this is in Moscow. It's on the ground, but it's a mission. It's a 500-plus day mission on the ground in a confined space, much like a module of something that you would expect to go to Mars, and they're studying the psychological effects of long-duration space flight. I suppose this is on the ground with normal gravity, correct?
Yes.
So and this is, they're, what, a couple of hundred days in or something like that? And is this just to see if you can handle the psychological effects of being confined together for well over a year?
Yeah, so analog studies, and there are ones happening in Russia. There have been ones in Hawaii. I think there's been one in the Southwest. There's a lot of different of these, like, human spaceflight analog studies where, yeah, people are locked in. And it's really testing both psychological effects but also operations. So when you have a bunch of people in a small confined space, you know, how do you build operations and ways of conducting, you know, science or different tasks that don't run into each other? In a sense, you can almost think of it like creating a kitchen to a restaurant. If you have a small kitchen, you have to come up with some really great protocols and ways of doing things so that you're not constantly running into each other, and that so tasks are flowing in a very fluid manner. So, yeah, it's studying all sorts of things, both human psychological factors, but also just ways of operating while you're in a confined space for a long period of time.
Now, in your book, you allude to astronauts needing a timeout, so to speak, or a bit of alone time. And it's funny. It's the famous dorm routine where they put a sock on the outside of the compartment. It says, I guess that's the symbol for leave me alone.
Yeah. It was funny. It sounds like essentially different crews on the International Space Station will invent different ways of sort of giving each other privacy. And so I had heard the story from one astronaut. She was the only woman aboard the International Space Station with a crew of men. And so they had agreed on sort of putting a towel over the airlock as a sort of way of signaling, hey, I need some privacy, or, you know, I'm changing, or, you know, whatever it may be. And I thought that was definitely delightful that, yeah, they each crew creates sort of their own, yeah, sock over the doorknob sort of exchange for giving each other privacy when needed.
My guest today is Ariel Waldman. She is the founder of spacehack.org. She has served on a number of major space committees and also the global instigator of Science Hack Day. And she's a National Academy of Science Committee member, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. She's written a book, What It's Like in Space, Stories from Astronauts Who've Been There. Imagine that was a real great buzz to sort of interview astronauts. What do they want to talk about when they're talking about what it's like to be in space?
You know, that's funny, yeah, because in my experience with sitting down with astronauts, it was really great to get the stories that they were more into telling you one-on-one necessarily than staying on a full stage. So getting to hear from astronauts about, like, the more funny and humorous experiences that they've had in space, things that might even be a little bit embarrassing for them to share. And, yeah, the book so far, the reactions to it have been great. It's, you know, it really is a book for all ages, whether or not you want it for your family or you're just a single adult or you're a kid. It really is something that everyone is curious about, regardless of age. And so it's been great to really see people of all ages respond to it so well.
Yeah, and a lot of it has to do with bodily functions. And some of them will leave for people to read the book, but others, for example, burping, that just does not happen in space, does it not?
Yeah, so burping doesn't happen in space, or at least if you were to attempt to burp, it might not end up in such a great state. When you're here on the ground, you have gravity helping assist you to keep the solids in your stomach down while you release gas out of your mouth. But in space, you don't have gravity helping you do that. So if you were to attempt to burp in space, you would actually accidentally end up vomiting, which is not good. So this is exactly why there's no soda in space.
Yeah, and in fact, one astronaut came away with a way of creating by pushing himself off violently while he did it, he created sort of a microgravity effect. I'm not sure if that's the correct term, but enough of a centrifugal, maybe that's an effect that would keep his food down.
Yeah, so I only heard this from one astronaut, so I'm not sure if other astronauts have figured out this trick yet, but he claimed that he was able to burp by essentially holding onto a wall and then pushing himself off of that wall while he burped. And so, yeah, creating sort of like a opposite force effect enough so that he could burp and not have an accident when he did that. So, yeah, I don't know if other astronauts have figured that out yet or not, or if it's even worth risking considering the alternative that happened.
You write in the book that Douglas Adams was right about one thing about space travel in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and that towels in space are a necessity.
Absolutely. Yeah, towels are something that, because as you say, you're dealing with so many bodily fluid management issues while you're in space, whether it's, you know, sweat or mucus or what have you, that carrying a towel with you at all times is really important. But especially for the first few days while you're in space, because the majority of astronauts do get sick while they're in space. And so actually carrying a towel with you is important in case you feel like you're going to get ill. Because, again, if you throw up in space, that stuff's going to be floating around. It might actually bounce back into your face if you're trying to expel it. Like, all sorts of really bad, gross things can happen. So towels are really important to space travelers.
Now, there's actually a name for those beginning days, and it's called space adaptation syndrome. And there's actually, well, tell us about space adaptation syndrome.
Yeah, so space adaptation syndrome is just the fancy word for getting sick while you're in space over the first few days. And it's something that as I said, most astronauts actually experience it, but one astronaut in particular, Garn, actually experienced this so profoundly that he's become sort of this infamous astronaut for being the most sick in space anyone can ever be. And so astronauts in the 1980s actually created what they call a unit of Garn, and they measure how sick you are based on the senator who was an astronaut, how sick he was, and they say that no one could possibly be more sick than this senator got sick in space. So,
Ed Garn was one of the first non-astronauts to go up in the space shuttle at the time before the Challenger, when they were taking people like John Glenn and Garn in, and I guess he was did not adapt well to space.
Yeah, not at all.
One of the interesting things about it sounds like astronauts, in addition to all their official duties, and there's an awful lot of unofficial duties, they are using this time to sort of do sort of personal experiments. Like for those who go out on spacewalks, they are sniffing around in the airlock after they get back to get a sense of the smell of space. What did astronauts tell you about what space smells like? In the airlock, I assume space is interacting with that space, and then they repressurize it, and I guess they can get a smell of space. Is that correct?
Yeah, so astronauts obviously can't take off their helmets while they're doing spacewalks, but when they come back into a space station, they will remove their suits and everything, and they claim that there is a specific smell to space once they close the airlock, and that smell is something that sounds like it's very unique, but no one can quite place it. So some people have said space smells like fried steak. Other people have said welding fumes. One person said a burnt almond cookie. people have all sorts of ways of sort of describing what they think the smell of space is. So it sounds like to me there's definitely a smell, but no one can agree on what it is.
And now there's a sort of a hypothesis, a working hypothesis about what this, because what comes up in time again is sort of a burning smell or a burnt smell.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the hypothesis?
So the hypothesis about it has to do with essentially, you're in a space where you're surrounded by, as Carl Sagan would say, star stuff. You know, there's dead stars around, and so you're dealing with materials. Well, I wouldn't necessarily call it materials. You're dealing with molecules and such that have come from dead stars, and so people assume that the burnt sort of smell is not unlike sort of a, you know, what you would imagine with burnt out matches or something, because you are dealing with very hot things in the universe that end up going out. So that's sort of the simplest way I can describe it.
Now, beyond adapting to the microgravity environment as far as being healthy and being able to work in space, what are some of the most important issues? One of the things that seems to come up in the book over and over is figuring a way in which there is no up to find an up for your brain, an orientation.
Yeah, all astronauts have to figure out what direction to treat as up while they're in the space station. There is no such thing as up or down. And so not only when they're performing a task do they have to just consciously say, okay, I'm going to treat this direction as up for this task, but they also have to agree on this when they're talking to each other. So two astronauts who come together on the space station to talk to each other have to agree which way they're going to face each other, because they might come at each other from completely different directions and be completely upside down to each other. So so it really does sort of change how you think about space, like the physical space, in a profound way.
Is it important for their own brain orientation to know, to have a sort of a direction that they deem as up, just for simple tasks, or does the brain adapt?
So they always have to choose which way is up. From task to task or day to day, they can decide what they treat as up, but there isn't a consistent up or down, especially on the International Space Station. So in science fiction and in movies, we're used to seeing, you know, these long corridors on space stations, and they're completely minimalist, and it's very clear the way the space station is built, which way is up. But on the actual International Space Station, there is stuff on all four walls at all times because they're trying to use as much space as they can. And so there is really nothing in the space station itself that says, okay, this way is up at all times. So it is a fluid decision that astronauts' brains make every day.
You know, one of the other issues that's going to go into long duration space flight is being outside of Earth's orbit for, you know, a year or more, and also open to the emptiness of space. One of the things you write about in the book is something that astronauts refer to as cosmic fairies, but actually it's something a little more serious. It's cosmic rays and causing an image on their retina. Is this going to be an issue with long-duration space flight?
So the cosmic rays that go through, so what happens on the International Space Station currently is because, you're not protected by as much of the atmosphere on Earth as you are here on the ground. When cosmic rays enter the International Space Station, and if they happen to fly through the retina of or nerve of an astronaut, they will actually see flashes of light in their eyes despite their eyes being closed. This is a very unique effect of space exploration, and something that they're not too worried about, because ultimately NASA dedicates a lot of research towards figuring out how much radiation people can get over their lifetime, and they make sure not to send astronauts up over a certain percentage of radiation risk. For long-duration travel to Mars, the thing that's really interesting is that the best time to send astronauts to Mars over a long term, when they're really going to be without the protection of Earth's atmosphere at all, is actually when the sun is at its solar maximum. And this is at first sort of counterintuitive. You're like, why would you want the sun to be at its maximum strength when you send astronauts to Mars? And this is actually because when the sun is at its maximum strength, and when it's at solar maximum, it's actually creating a protective magnetosphere and protecting astronauts from galactic cosmic rays during their travel. So galactic cosmic rays are some of the worst cosmic rays that you can experience. And so actually having more protection against those is actually positive. So the thing that's really fascinating to me about this is when we're thinking about going to Mars, we're not only thinking about, you know, Earth and Mars alignment in terms of reducing the amount of days people have to spend in space, but we're also talking about looking at what the current state of the sun is like so that we can pick the best time so that astronauts will experience the least amount of radiation possible.
Earlier we were talking about how they're studying the psychological elements of a long-duration space flight. You know, all of our space flights so far have been where you're in Earth orbit and you're looking down on Earth, and you can look down on the Earth at any time and see home, if you will. If you went to the moon, you could still see the Earth slightly larger than the moon from moon orbit. But, you know, if you go to Mars, the Earth becomes a star. I think that would, and there would be no home to be seen. I think that would be psychologically a different kettle of fish, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with you. It's definitely a different thing. One of the most fascinating things about that you hear from the astronauts who did go to the moon is, you know, everyone was so focused about experiencing the moon and what is the moon like and what is it like to be on the moon. But the thing that was most profound for most of those astronauts was being able to look at the Earth from the moon. That's what they really enjoyed and were absolutely delighted by unexpectedly. And so going to Mars is really a different thing because, you know, you might be able to see the Earth for a little bit on your journey, but once you get there, it's not the same at all.
Yeah. And I was struck by something Rusty Schweiker, you quoted him in the book. He was an Apollo astronaut, and he said, you know, one of the things about being an astronaut is you're scheduled to the nth degree of things you have to do. He says there's, you know, finding the time to be in awe is one of those really exciting things, and it's often not all that common as we might expect on the ground. You know, to be in space would be a completely awesome experience, and just sensing microgravity, looking at the Earth from afar. But it was not something astronauts get a whole lot of time to do either.
Yeah, it's really not, which is sad, but also understandable in some ways. Whether you're a government astronaut or a privately funded astronaut, you are training a lot for a long time. And especially if you're a government astronaut, then you are spending, you know, countless years of your life towards training and getting everything meticulously scripted. So, and this makes sense for a lot of operations in space. So, for instance, on spacewalks, while spacewalks are really cool, you get to actually go out in space and you're in this, you know, spacesuit and you get to experience space more fully. NASA doesn't want astronauts to do that unless they absolutely have to, because it is a risk to human life. And so when people do perform spacewalks, every minute is absolutely scripted. And so from some of the astronauts that perform spacewalks, the only time that they really got to really appreciate their time in space is if something glitched, like if some piece of equipment didn't work and they had to wait a few minutes while someone else repaired it. And so that really only getting, you know, 5 minutes or so to experience space is all they got. And so this was also true with Rusty Schweikert. And so the astronauts who have been able to really fully appreciate being in space during a spacewalk or their time on the moon has been when things actually didn't go exactly as scripted and they got a few extra minutes to actually experience space. This is, you know, sad, but it's the reality of space exploration is that, you know, it's not routine and you can't take it for granted. You know, you can't necessarily enjoy it like George Clooney in Gravity all the time.
Well, one of the interesting things about your book was once astronauts come back down to Earth, we know we can imagine what the gravitational effects of readjusting to gravity, but some of the after effects of space, they actually dream of floating. Their dreams, or they dream of Earth with microgravity. That must be very disconcerting.
Yeah, it's, you know, it sounds delightful, but I am curious how much it's actually a bit troubling. So for astronauts while they're in space, some will have backwards dreams where they'll be back on Earth, but gravity will be a bit off. And so they have these really awkward dreams where they're trying to navigate being on Earth, but with everything floating around, or they're not able to reach things as easily. And then equally, when astronauts come back to Earth, they oftentimes will wake up in the morning, and when they wake up, they'll actually, for a few moments before they get themselves together, actually will think that they're floating above their bedroom or that they're floating at a weird angle. And this goes back to, as we were talking about, you have to always be deciding which way is up. And so, of course, if you get used to that and you come back to Earth, for a while your brain is going to be asking you, which way is up?
Well, it's a really interesting book for families and kids, What It's Like in Space. Ariel Waldman, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ariel Waldman is the global director of Science Hack Day and the founder of spacehack.org. Her latest book is titled What It's Like in Space, Stories from Astronauts Who've Been There. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. We'll be off for the Memorial Day holiday. We'll be featuring the best of Studio Tulsa tomorrow and Monday. We'll be back with new episodes on Tuesday. Thanks for listening. I'm Rich Fisher.